He's right in front of me, and I can honestly tell him that I'm going to knock him spark out. Leaping right hand by the Prince. Ooh. And a hard left. And Kelly's down for the third time.
Whoa! He's for real. The
unbelievable.
For real.
One more touch to go. And Cardiff has gone. Bernard Dunne is the champion of the world. Bernard Dunne is the champion of the world. Fantastic, Bernard. Fantastic.
And here comes
Hello and welcome to Off The Brawl on Off The Ball. I'm Ronan Mullen, back from Philadelphia, recharged, revitalised, joined by Phil Egan, Simon Maguire and former middleweight champion of the world, Andy Lee. Did you miss me last week?
Let's not just say Andy Lee. Okay?
No. you're going to be referred to that forever.
Not cigarette, but you'd never get cigarette
possibly
every time. You must get cigarette.
I'd never. Never.
Where were you, Andy? I'd be walking into the office saying you refer to me as champ, and that's it.
like
this morning.
Speaking of world champions, 10 years to the day since Bernard Dunne won his world title against Ricardo Cordoba. Andy, you were on the card?
Yeah, I fought a Serbian guy, tough guy, had a hard fight with him. A great night though, wasn't it?
Oh, it was unbelievable. Like the day that was in it. I remember watching the rugby at home, ironing my shirt to go to the, what was it? It was the O2 back then.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't wait. It was one of the best events I've ever been to, if not the best, just given what had happened against Kiko Martinez. And I was disappointed that night, not only for Bernard Dunne, but I thought the crowd that night just walked out of the place almost like, you know, it was like they turned their back on Bernard Dunne. But when he gave us that night against Cordoba, and then even when he lost to Poonsworth, even though he lost, the crowd stayed around and they kind of applauded them and said, you know, what you've done for Irish boxing. It was amazing. Like, the fight itself was class.
Mm. Like you said about Irish, like, his legacy is still living on now, you know. The young boxers he inspired. And for me, on a personal level, getting to fight in his undercards and having that kind of, without him, there'd be no boxing. Like, there were how many years before, like, before there was, like, mainstream boxing on TV in Ireland.
Yeah.
And he brought that, you know, brought that to Ireland, and I got to fight. And yeah, his legacy is still felt. But what a night! What a performance! What a comeback! Like, when it looked like he was losing it, it was all lost. And just he broke Cordoba's heart, and what a fight!
And what was the vibe like for you having fought? Did you move into the main crowd then for the fight?
Yeah, I kind of stood on the ramp and watched it from like an elevated position. I just watched it. I was back from afar. And, like, sometimes it's nice to watch it like that because you get to see the fight, and then you get to see the crowd. I was kind of facing the crowd. Another way, it's kind of like a theatre kind of setup in the O2 then. And just to see the drama, and yeah, it was
electric, wasn't it?
I remember running down when he did win, running down to the ring, like, yeah, like just pure emotion. Like, obviously, I probably would never do that, like, you know, if I was in my conscience, but just ran down and like fist pump up to the ring, like, come on, you know. Yeah. What a feeling.
And the drama of it, we have it in our intro, just the commentary from Jimmy McGee, and it's kind of the thing, some commentators are accused of scripting their stuff, but you couldn't possibly have scripted for a fight like that. And it's almost like a dictionary term now, Bernard Dunne days, it gets brought up, like, are we ever going to get those days back, those heady days? Simon, what are your memories of it?
Well, I think sometimes we can get in a cocoon when it's a good Irish fight, and we might over-amplify how good it actually was, but that was in consideration for the Ring Magazine's Fight of the Year and Round of the Year. Now, ultimately, it lost out to Israel Vasquez and Rafael Marquez. But if you're going to lose out to any fight, you're going to lose out to that one. So that alone shows how good the fight was, how competitive it was, and it was seen around the world. And I think, you know, the fact that Bernard won it in such a dramatic fashion as well amplified his own title reign, you know, and just kind of, it kind of signified his career, I think. It was the keystone moment of his career, and we're 10 years on and we're still talking about it, you know, and I think it was a fantastic day for Irish boxing.
So, Phil, would you say his legacy is sort of beyond his own career? It's kind of what he's left behind almost, as much as what he did in the ring himself?
Yeah, like, it just, like, I could just remember when he won, like, the atmosphere in the place was unbelievable. Like, his interview after, it was just
hunky-dory.
It was, okay. But anyone that asked me, like, you know, what is it about boxing that you love? Like, that night was it. Like, it was just the performance. You know, he was in trouble. You thought, right, is he going to be able to pull this out of the bag? Then he wins. Like, as I said, the noise, like, the roof was lifted off the place when he won. It was just incredible. And, like, one of the first fights I ever actually went to see was when he lost to Kiko Martinez. Mm. And, again, like, the atmosphere was building for that fight. And, you know, when he got knocked out within 90 seconds, like, the place was just deserted. You could stick a, you know, you could hear a pin drop in the place. And it was such a disappointment for him. So when he won the world title, I was just so happy for him because, you know yourself, and
yeah, well,
like if you're fighting on the biggest stage and you get knocked out in 90 seconds, like a defeat, but a defeat in that manner must be
But that's kind of why it's remembered so fondly as well, the win against Cordoba, and how he's just remembered so fondly because it was there, it was played out in the most public way like that. He had this crushing defeat when he was supposed, like, no one even heard of Kiko Martinez, and he was supposed to basically walk in the park, like a routine defense of his European title, and then he got crushed. But then to build himself back up and come back when no one really gave him much of a chance, and especially against Cordoba, who was like a serious champion at that time, and then to come back and win like that's character. You know what I mean? That's heart. That's all the things that you want to see in a human being, not just as a boxer. That's why the story is so. That's why it's so fondly remembered.
Mm. And Kiko Martinez, you mentioned a relative unknown before that fight, and he's since become sort of a staple of Irish boxing. Mm. He's boxed basically everyone at that weight, and two fights with Carl Frampton. The first one particularly memorable, and the second one, Frampton won the world title. So I don't think many would have thought Kiko Martinez would be in our memories so long after, but here we are anyway. Unfortunately, a lot of our big nights take place elsewhere these days, not least Katie Taylor, who co-headlined at in Philadelphia at the Leah Chorus Centre. I was there. It was a great night, a great event.
What's the second or third time he's mentioned he was there?
Were you in Philadelphia?
Was there, third time, I would say. I have to say, it was a brilliant event. I'm not sure if it quite got to the numbers Eddie Hearn had pegged that it was going to be the biggest crowd. It was kind of similar to Boston, I would have said, but in terms of the recipe of what went down, it just blended really nicely. The Philly fighters really stood up on the night. There was a great Irish representation, and the main TV fights were all excellent. So we may as well start with Katie, because more history for her, first three-belt champion in the four-belt era from Ireland. So what did you think of her performance?
Thought it was going to be a quick night for her after she put her down in the first, but yeah, very impressive. I know we talked about it last week, Andy, with like what you were looking to see from Katie Taylor and the strategy. Now, she definitely seemed to go to the body a lot. There was a few times where
there were signs that she was picking her shots more, being more, I guess, strategic or thinking about what she was doing. She had a perfect start. But then when she dropped Volante, she kind of came back to her, like, trying to finish it. But then she kind of got back to herself again, kind of regrouped and stuck to her boxing. And it was a really solid performance. Like, Volante was tough. She technically many levels behind Katie, but put up a tough show and gave Katie a good run.
It was funny with the knockdown. It looked like I only really saw the left hook from my vantage point, so it was kind of a grazing shot. I thought it was a balance thing, but when you look back at it, it was a brilliant short right hand and like the picture perfect stuff. And I was really impressed with Katie because she went through a couple of different game plans in that fight, or maybe not game plans, but just approaches. So Volante was trying to take her head off in the first round, and she stood with her, kind of prove, you know, I'm not going to be bullied here. And then sort of outboxed her a few rounds after that, and then started to walk her down, which was incredible when you're there because it looked like, you know, Volante had seemed bigger, and it just looked like Katie had bullied or broken her heart, and it was a clash of heads to end of things, but I think Volante was pretty happy to get out of there.
Yeah, the writing was on the wall.
Yeah, she gave the whole ref, it was a headbutt, but sure, we caught it off. Anyway, we're kind of running out of superlatives now for Katie, and at the level she is above these competitors, and look, at the end of the day, she was just faster, fitter, stronger than Volante, and got the job done.
Yeah, and Delphine Persoon seems all but set for June the 1st on the Anthony Joshua undercard, which would be the co-feature or the chief support at least. Persoon, Eddie Hearn described her afterwards as a female Carl Froch, which kind of gives you a good picture of what to expect. So really long arms, and I don't know if you caught her recent fight, it was streamed on YouTube, but just very busy and powerful and has been champion for 9 years, so that's going to be a tough fight.
Yeah, I think it's probably the biggest challenge for Katie out there, whether she can beat Katie or not, but she'll definitely pose, I think she'll be Katie's biggest challenge this far into her career, because of, even though she might be behind Katie technically, in terms of her confidence and her own self-esteem and belief, she's on a level with Katie, so she'll be coming into the fight with, like, where her previous opponents might not have thought they were going to win, and you've seen that in their performances, because they'd be fighting so defensively. Poonsum will come to win.
So that suit Katie, though.
Should make for a good contest. Yeah, should bring out the best in Katie and show her the best.
Yeah, and in the press conference afterwards, there were kind of, as there always is, chatter about future fights with Amanda Serrano or Brighouse, that kind of thing. But she kind of cut across that and said, "This is the toughest fight." So in her opinion, like, this is the toughest one, and the other ones are more glamour sort of, you know, profile builders. Whereas from a technical standpoint, she reckons this is going to be her toughest one.
And I like to see a little bit of, not attitude, but like, you know, Katie, she's so humble and respectful, and she was saying, like, the Serrano sisters, they picked their fights very carefully.
Yeah.
So a little bit of a kick.
I'm not sure she has the heart for it.
Yeah, I like this. I like
she's learning.
Yeah, it's good. And it's just enough to draw them out maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I think Amanda Serrano signed a contract which includes a Katie Taylor fight, so if she does back out, everyone's going to know about it. So that fight should happen, but as we said, Persoon is going to be a tough one to get over. The main event on the night was John O'Carroll, who, a brave performance if outclassed on the night, probably, but again, I was impressed with Tevin Farmer. Probably, I underestimated him slightly against James Tennyson, and probably a little bit more this time. He kind of fought Carroll's fight and still bossed it. Even though Carroll threw 1,227 punches, which is obscene, but I don't know. I was impressed with Carroll's heart, and even after the fight, he seemed proud of what he did. So you can't really ask for much more than that.
What was it like? Were you scoring it there without commentary? How were you? What were you seeing those early rounds like?
I thought it was closer than
was really putting.
Yeah,
it out,
I thought it was closer than it turned out to be on the cards. Now
that the like there was a fair Irish crowd there as well, though.
Yeah, he was so busy though. Like there were rounds when Farmer wasn't doing much, and you have to score it round by round, even if the feeling of the fight would suggest one guy is winning. In the 3 minute increment, it's like, you know, Carroll landed more shots in that round. You have to give him a couple.
See, Carroll would land all those busy punches, and then Farmer would land one big or two big.
Mm.
And for me, the difference was Farmer could rest in there. You know, when Jono was doing his best work, Farmer might have been just taking a rest or was able to be defensive and sit in there.
Yeah.
But when Jono wanted to take breaks, he wasn't able to. Be as elusive or to nullify Farmer in a sense, you know. So, like you said, it was a lot of effort, and they were scoring punches, but the big shots, the eye-catching shots that were really punctuate around and say, well, who when you look back, who won that round would be from Farmer. And there's a little bit more substance to it. He's not, you know, there's certain fighters who have that style, that kind of slick style on side. You think like Malignaggi, Collazo, kind of a style that's like, it's kind of trying to emulate Pernell Whitaker, kind of a thing, you know. But he's got some more substance than just having that flash style as well, Farmer.
Yeah, no, I was very impressed with, as you said, he's impressive physically as well. He looked big. He fought Jono's fight.
He looked huge compared to Carroll.
He struggled at the weight. He admitted that probably recklessly in the press conference. He was like, making weight's always tough, so. He probably shouldn't be mentioning that in public.
Yeah, but that's also a psychological thing as well, because if you're making the weight easy, you're like, oh, you know, this guy's coming in, and then you're thinking about the next day when you actually do fight, how big is he going to be come to fight? And you could see how big he was. And so even admitting you have a weight problem, even though it's a struggle, and you're admitting you're having a struggle, it's also a win in a psychological way, because you're saying, like, I'm going to be huge the next day. You know, I'm going to be huge by the time I rehydrate. So it's always negative to it.
Chavez was huge when he fought.
Yeah. And we've said it before, that's why there's weight divisions, because you just can't hold them off. Like, you could see Jono was landing his shots, and they were having an effect, but when Farmer landed his shots, it was like a different weight division. And there's levels and whatever, but there's leagues in terms of when you get to the top level in boxing. The guys are always so much bigger. You know, they're so much bigger it's like Champions League weight, you know. It's like they're so much bigger, and that's why everyone, that's why they do struggle to make the weight, you know. That's why you have to be, you have to be certain. Like, interesting, during the commentary on Mike Conlon's fight, which I'm sure we'll speak about in a while, they were talking about him dropping down a weight division, that his best days might not be at featherweight, that he might drop down to super bantam, which would be interesting, you know.
Yeah, well, he's definitely young enough to make that decision if it's something he wants to do. But just on Jono, he spoke kind of veiledly about the tactics he was going to use, and he said it would be apparent almost immediately what he was going to do. As it turned out, he mentioned afterwards that he got a cut and he was worried that it was going to be stopped and go to the cards, so he wanted to win a couple of the first four rounds in case that happened, which is probably decent logic, but it kind of threw him off his game plan. And he seemed to panic in the middle of the fight and was just throwing punches for punch's sake, which if he had it over again, he seemed kind of disappointed in himself that he didn't carry through the game plan, and his coach was just like throwing his hands in the air like, you know, these things happen. But we mentioned Chavez there, Andy, and you fell short the first time and then came back. Did that stand you in good stead, that experience, knowing being in that world title environment almost?
Yeah. Like, obviously,
and that was a lot of
regrets about that fight with Chavez, and I'm sure, like, as you saw, and Jono will have them. I should have done this, could have done that, and he'll be tossing that over. I know he was kind of buoyant after the fight, and the next day it was good video of him going and getting a cheesesteak with.
Did you get
Farmer.
A cheesesteak?
I did, yeah. I'm still recovering from it.
But whenever one saw it die down, he's at home and it's quiet, he'll be thinking, should have done this, or could have done that, or what if this had gone different? And it was a clash of heads that caused it, that wasn't called. And it will stand him. Yeah, it will stand him, of course. He's on that level now, and he's shown that he competed at that level. So, look, there'll be somebody out there who he'll beat with a world title.
Yeah.
Because
he's got plenty of offers.
Because of his attention to, yeah. And his personality.
Eddie Hearn said it after, that Lou DiBella was there going, you know, where'd you get this guy?
Yeah,
he's brilliant to watch.
Yeah, and his personality. And that was a cracking fight. You know, the action was unreal, you know.
And he charmed everybody there, it seemed. And as you said, Lou DiBella coming out gesturing like, Jesus, who is this guy exactly? So
The ref did nearly go full Joe Cortez in the Floyd Mayweather-Ricky Hatton fight. Like, any time they touched, he was calling break straight away, and I felt that kind of...
The ref did let a lot of those punches shy low, so I was kind of giving
it
him...
It was unbelievable.
I could hear, he was saying, that's the belt. He was saying, like, he's hitting the belt.
Yeah.
He was going well south of the belt anyway, like, and so I was like, give that referee a pass, because he was letting so many low blows pass.
There was, like, they were throwing right hooks, left hooks, and like shoulders as well between the two of them, and then anytime they got close, then like after about 30 seconds it was break, keep them up, and they're hitting each other in the knee and stuff.
That was funny you mentioned, like, Carl would be lacing like five low blows and then Farmer would just come back with one big one just to say stop. Yeah, I can do that too. I remember when we interviewed Jono before the fight, he took exception when I said, would you not have thought of rematching Francois, and he was like, no, I'm in for the big fights. But I meant it more from a psychological point of view. Like, he jumped up for almost from domestic level, Fenwell was sort of European level, and then to world level. I thought he might have wanted to clear that hurdle in his own mind to know, right, I know how good I am at that level, I can make the jump now.
No, but see, you know, sometimes, for one, in the physical way, you got to train for it, you got to go, anything going to happen then in the rematch. But in some ways, like, you can't really go, I know going through the levels, and you think, like, I want to do this to show, prove to myself, but sometimes you just got to put yourself on the level, you know, and... like, he's shown now, I think, with that performance to Tevin Farmer fight, you could almost say, yeah, well, you caught, like, you kind of dismissed the Francois performance now.
Yeah, what does he do next, though? If he's fought at world level and that was a European level, what's his next step?
Just try and stay at world level. Try and fight one of the guys there, if not a champion, a former champion who's a name.
Yeah.
And stay at that level. And get on a big show again, you know.
Because he's only 16 fights before that, and he's only 26 years old, very young pro, given that he had basically year chunks in the middle of his career that he was inactive. So lots of time on his side, he's still fresh. You saw that the other night, he never stopped. He could have done 15 rounds probably. So although the 11th round, I was a bit worried. He was getting tagged pretty clean, and like, it was kind of a moral victory almost in the end that he got to hear the final bell.
Yeah. Good fight, though. And a good fighter, like, in terms of his technique, and his style.
He's a good all-rounder, isn't he?
Yeah, he's got great punch selection and the engine, as you mentioned. So, he's got a big future.
Yeah, and just on the Irish side of things, it was quite sad, disappointing in the end. John Evan didn't actually get on the main card. He was afloat, which struck me immediately. It was a bit strange. although he's not a matchroom fighter, so they kind of have to look after their own at the end of the day. So he was. There was a couple of fights that went long at the start of the card. Even the debutant from America went the full rounds, so they couldn't slot him in, and like it was basically an empty venue when he fought, and he'd sold a lot.
He was waiting around for 7 hours or something. Yeah,
he'd sold an awful lot of tickets. Like you could see them sort of up in the background, and it was kind of grim, you know.
It's
such a talented guy, and you could see it in glimpses that he still got the raw ability, but it's just it was kind of sad.
How did he box? What did you think of his performance? And
it's something we say a lot. Just the it's difficult to get these guys out of there. Your man was in there basically just to get a paycheck and survive. He boxed well, as I said, in glimpses you could see the counter punching and you know good reflexes. But I think Eddie Hearn sort of promised him next time we're back we'll get you back on and a proper show. So hopefully that can happen.
Well, if you saw Luke Campbell, obviously
I was going to say on the flip side, how impressive, like. Unbelievably good. The best I've seen him. I wasn't overly sure about his opponent before and had a look. He's decent, the guy he fought, and Campbell just levelled above. And just, you could see the Shane McGuigan influence, just a slightly different style, almost like Carl Frampton-esque, I thought. And the shot that put your man in retreat mode at the end, the right hand, it was a great shot.
Yeah, brilliant shot, yeah. He's now going to get a chance. Like, there's a world title in him, definitely.
Mm. So he's mandatory for Mikey Garcia, who we'll talk about later on. Mikey he won that title 2 years ago, the WBC, and hasn't defended it in over a year. So I think the onus is almost on him to either give that up or defend it against Luke. And I wouldn't be so sure after the weekend. You know, I'd give Luke a good chance. I thought he beat Jorge Linares that time. And you kind of forget, you look at him, when he turned pro, he was 27, I think, but he's got those boyish sort of looks that you think he's a lot younger than he is. So it's kind of his time now. It's sort of now or never for Luke Campbell.
And he obviously, like the story behind him as well, like, you know, he's had a tough couple of years outside the ring. So it kind of does seem like it's all set up now that he is ready to win that world title that we kind of thought he would after winning the gold medal.
Yeah, and after them, Jesus, Rosado Seletsky, did you see that one?
I did, yeah. It's unbelievable.
It was a good scrap, almost a little bit one-sided to begin with. The knockdown early on put it in Seletsky's favour, but then Rosado came storming back at the end. It was almost like a Rocky film in Philadelphia. It didn't seem it was coming, and then he just knocked him down, and he almost had him out, I think, another 30 seconds or so.
No, like if it was a 12-rounder, you're thinking that Rosado wins it.
What did you think of it, Andy?
Yeah, I thought Rosado looked... You could see the career he's had... In the first few moments of the fight, his legs look bad to me. And he gets caught with a right hand on the head, temple really, on top of the side of the head, and he's down. And, like, his legs, I think, you know, he's had a long career. He's had a lot of hard fights and another loss. And it's hard to see where he goes. I thought it was a good fight. Seletsky's decent, but, like, he should have got him out. Seletsky should have pressed on. Like, he had him hurt in the first round, didn't. Was kind of just happy to, like, professionally go after him, but... Saying that, Seletsky fought at a good pace for a middleweight. They fought at, like, he was pressuring him, and he's a big middleweight, but yeah, they're not top guys either of them. I thought it was a good fight, good matchup, but not a top level boxer.
Did you come across the in your time though?
Rosado?
Yeah.
No, I never did. The first time I became aware of him, he was scheduled to fight on ESPN Wednesday night fights against James Moore, the former Irish amateur star. And James was on the way up, you know, he was fighting on a lot of those John Duddy cards, and all of a sudden he gets beaten by this guy, and I was like, who would be James? And it was Gabriel Rosado. And so you can see what he's done since then, that it worked. Like for James more or less retired after that.
Yeah.
He had one more fight against Powell Warlock. Do you remember that guy? Another guy who went on to fight for a world title. And it wasn't a bad loss for James because he's like you.
Yeah.
Rosado's a world... Well, he's not world level, but he's a world fringe contender.
Yeah, because if you look at his record, it's a who's who of the middleweight division. He's lost basically 99% of them, but he's boxed at that level for his whole career, more or less. It was funny, the Irish journalists were almost trying to be, you know, impartial with the Irish lads were on, but when the Polish lads were on, it was like they were going ballistic, cheering in the press section. It's quite funny, but... Rosado
Polish
actually,
media.
Yeah, the Polish media are going ballistic for Seletsky, so it's quite funny to see.
So they reckon he's going to fight Demetrius Andrade.
That's going to happen, yeah. Mm. Unless they rematch that, which I think is unlikely. Rosado actually was talking about fighting Kell Brook, moving down to 154 and fighting Kell Brook on the Joshua card, which would be, it'd be a good fight for Brooke.
It'd be a good fight for both of them.
Yeah.
Good fight for you. I assume you're going over, are you?
I'll be there. Don't worry. don't you worry about that. Funny, earlier on their card, it was Yelusinov. Have you seen much of him, Andy?
No.
The guy.
Oh, I see a bit of him. Yeah, I see a bit of him on the TV. Yeah,
hasn't really caught fire, like, as a pro.
Had some, like, you. For those guys to cross over from Eastern Europe, they have to have a really fan-pleasing style. Like, and he, and in a way, he does. He's a lovely boxer, technically very good, but he's not a Golovkin, he's not a Lomachenko, he's not a Usyk, he's not a go forward and knock you out type of a fella, you know? That's what you have to have.
Yeah, it seemed that he was almost not stimulated by the fight. He was just kind of going through the motions, which is all well and good, but you're trying to sell yourself almost. And Usyk is going to be debuting in America, and you can be sure he's going to go out there and try and put on a show.
Well, Usyk has a huge personality as well. What the other guys don't, well, Lomachenko to an extent, but Usyk has the personality kind of, you know, he's a comical figure in a way.
Great dancer.
Yeah.
And like, he said, build up to the Belly fight, they tried to paint him as the second coming of Ivan Drago, you know, this beast from the East. And he's there, you know, joking around with Belly and jumping, you know, he's rabbit fingers over his head and all this stuff when he's doing interviews, and you're kind of going, right, we got that one wrong, lads.
Yeah, well, on Usyk, just briefly, it seems May 18th is the likely date for him in America against Carlos Takam or Povetkin, so either one of them would be a decent debut at heavyweight. Takam, obviously a very winnable fight, Povetkin would be a very dangerous one to take early on, but you'd still fancy Usyk at this stage of their careers.
Yeah, just at this crossroads and age and wear and tear on Povetkin, but two good names for him.
Yeah. So that was Friday night, and then on Sunday night, St. Patrick's Day itself, was Michael Conlon. I was watching this on a grainy phone, but I still, was it a conclusive enough performance from Conlon?
Yeah, like, he came out in the first round straight away into Southpaw. So what's he trying to achieve there? Like, I know it's something he did as an amateur. He's quite comfortable. It worked well where, you know yourself, Andy, where he's trying to get his right foot outside his opponent's left foot, and it actually worked well. He was able to get body shots off quite easily. It actually looked so easy, you were thinking it's rare you see it, because he got his foot outside and he was pretty much on him, hitting him in the body. It's rare you see defences breach that easily.
Yeah, he looks good. He can fight either way. He's effective either way. I don't know which. Sometimes, when just going back to when he fought Jason Cunningham, I thought he was much better as a southpaw. It was more effective as that. He was fighting a southpaw then, so maybe that's why he did it. But I guess he just sees what he sees when he's in there, and chooses to switch whatever stance suits him. I thought it was a good performance by him. I thought, you know, all he lacked was the knockout. You know, and that's the only thing he has to do now is try and find a way to knock these guys out, because
that's the currency in America. Yeah,
and it just kind of makes it a little bit more special. You know, it's a good performance by him. Probably his best.
What do you think of that? Like, because I think of, say, he's talking about Josh Warrington. Mm. Now, Warrington doesn't have a big knockout ratio, but when you watch Warrington, the pace he fights at is relentless. What do you think of the pace that Conlon fights at?
Yeah, it's more of a. Like, Warrington is a different fighter, and you have a clever game plan to fight him, because he moves around, and has his rest while he's moving, and then he'll unleash a 20-second barrage of punches, and it's very hard to combat that and to defend against that, and then he'll get back to his moving around and rest in the ring. So he's very explosive, and that's a hard style to box against. Do you follow him when he's been moving, when he's being defensive, and then when he does attack, what do? You try and match him, which Frampton did early on and paid the price, or do you try to move back? It's just... I think Mike could live with the pace, because Michael fights... I know his pace is a lot more assured, isn't it? It's a lot more kind of methodical more, and...
Seems more controlled.
Yeah, controlled. But I think Michael can live at a hard pace. That was a good 10 rounds he did against that guy. And I don't know. Like, I think he's got some ways to go to get to that level yet, to get to that kind of Warrington level yet, yeah.
And he was speaking to you before the fight. He said this time next year at this venue, I want to be fighting for a world title. Whether he's actually, if he's near that level, he's kind of putting himself on the clock, that's where he wants to be.
Yeah, but maybe we should be looking at super bantamweights, because if Adam's mentioned that, believe me, Adam's done, like, when Adam didn't make me move that would encouraged me to move to like 154. We did body fats, we did hydration levels, we did all these things before and after training. And he said, you can make, to me, he said, you can make 11 stone. And I didn't believe him, but I did. And I made it for 3 fights. And he's saying that Michael can make super bantam, then I believe that they've done that already. And you wouldn't be surprised if the next fight, it's somewhere in between feather and super bantam, and then after that, you'll see Michael at super bantamweight.
And Booth obviously has this notorious distinctive style, the high twitch sort of stuff. Is there anything, I know he's improved performance-wise in his last 2 fights, but is there anything specifically he's doing differently that he would have been doing when he first turned pro?
I hope I'm not speaking out of school here, but I remember that when Michael first went out and said, I need to work on his legs. And I can see now Michael has, I love the feints. You know, he's bouncing a little bit on his toes, but not as much as he was as an amateur. And he's just like feinting into the guy and then pulling out. And the head movement, which is boof all over, you know, you can start to see. And it takes time. Me and Adam would speak, and I spoke to Michael about it. It does take time to, especially when he's been ingrained in the style for so long and as an amateur.
His stance was always quite wide.
Yeah, yeah. Adam does like a wide stance too. That's for basically for power and stability, and also you're sitting lower in your punches, so you're not as much as a target up high. But we'll see. It's going to take time. Now it's just about him. I think he's kind of bridged that gap, and he's coming into that kind of boost style. Now it's about trying to find a way to knock these opponents out.
What better opponent to knock out in his next fight than Nick Eaton?
Yeah. What was he like on the card? Did you get a chance to see?
I've seen some highlights of him.
Yeah, they showed highlights during the.
Didn't look like he looked like he went the distance, and looked like he had a
majority decision, wasn't it?
Yeah, looked like he had a tough night in his last fight as well. So that would be a nice one to get a knockout from.
Can you imagine in Belfast the kind of reception he's going to get?
I'll make it to the ring.
It seems like they're going to do a big show in Belfast in the summer, so that's the.
You know, you'd be surprised. When Belfast is such a great boxing town, when he gets there, he'll have the utmost. They'll have to hide respect for him.
Yeah.
No, maybe not on the fight night when he's in the ring, but around the city and at the week of the fight, he'll be given.
Yeah, it's
respect.
An easy one to sell as well. You can just imagine the way they'll package it. I thought it was interesting the way they packaged Conlon on, like, it was an ESPN card which was shown on Box Nation, but just the videos beforehand, you know, going around Belfast, Conlon talking about his past and his problems with drugs and who he used to hang around with. And also as well, something I wanted to ask you, because it came up in commentary. Now, when I was watching it, I wasn't sure if it was Andre Ward or Timothy Bradley that brought it up, but they were talking about Conlon, and they were talking about when you're fighting, trying to work out the next move of your opponent.
Mm.
I said, I don't know if it was Bradley or Ward that said it. They used to study the fighter's chest. They could tell by looking at their chest the next move, like the way they flexed their muscles, which way they were going to go, rather than maybe, I don't know, like, yeah. Did you look at the eyes? Did you?
Sometimes, you don't constantly think of it. You obviously have to look somewhere.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's the eyes, and sometimes it is the chest or this kind of neck area, you know? And you're not looking for anything. It's not like, oh, look at that muscle twitch and he's gonna jab now. You know, it's like it's subconscious, because those are the things you pick up subconsciously, you can see happening in your training, in your sparring and all that. And then that's just where your focus is. I always looked at the eyes, I think, more so. Those are the instincts you build up over the years. And that's what it's all about, thinking 2 or 3 steps ahead.
Yeah, and Teddy Atlas always says, against elusive fighters like Tevin Farmer, for example, where the head movement is good, aim for the chest because the chest doesn't move, so maybe that's a little bit of it as well. Just, it's a good way to land your shots, or be sure to do so.
Aim for the chin. No, aim for the chest. If the chin's moving that way, just aim for it, you know what I mean?
Like, the chin might not be there when you...
Have you ever seen a really good scoring shot in the chest?
No, I think you're called Teddy Atlas rhetoric.
I think you mean...
I know what you mean.
If you aim for the chest,
you gotta hit one in the
chin
middle.
Might be there by the time.
Yeah, but like...
If you aim for the chin,
that's like a...
Your head will be gone.
Okay, so this thing's going like this. Tick-tock, head move, and I'm going to keep punching down the middle, and hopefully, I get one of these shots down the middle.
That's Teddy Atlas
for you. Aim the chin.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
no. It's just like, I always think that.
Teddy's got a very good podcast as well.
Aim for the chin. Aim for the chest.
All right, Teddy, sorry about that. In Boston on Saturday night, wins for Niall Kennedy, who told the Boston crowd to go and get as full as a bingo bus after his first round knockout. So he enjoyed his night. And then Spike down at 154, you mentioned. At this stage in his career, it's a bit late to be making a move down, is it?
Well, the big thing for him is he hopes that Dennis Hogan can win. You know, then if Dennis Hogan win the world title beating Jamie Moniga, is it Moniga?
Munguia, isn't it?
Munguia. That's the easy fight to make, isn't it? The two of them, maybe in Ireland, yeah, who knows? Anywhere on the east coast of America, it's a huge
fight. Even
or
nowhere.
Even in Australia, there's so many markets for it. Mm. And that would be a great fight for them. So that's, I think he said he's going to go down there to Mexico and watch the fight, be ringside, and challenge the winner.
Yeah. He's called himself some people are calling him the hardest hitting 11 stone fighter in the world now, so I'm not sure about that. But how did you feel having stepped down to 154? Did you feel the same? Was it the same sort of power?
I felt no different, really. You know, I felt no different. I was smaller physically. I didn't feel any. I probably felt more power because I was lighter. I kind of maintain my power, and it's look, you have to do it correctly, and I hope they are doing it correctly, because you have to test, like, we with Adam, he's so scientific with it. We would testing my strength all the time, you know, and I was doing the same weights for a period of time at 160, and then when it came to when I maintained those weights, and I actually got a little bit stronger at 11 stone. So we were doing those tests with weights. It's very hard to measure.
How long is that process?
I've been doing the same weights for the year and a half that I was with Adam, 2 years, and then once we went into I joined Adam in would have been September of 2012, and then it would have been the summer of 2014 that I went to 11 stone. So, course of 2 years, and so I had that previous knowledge at the heavyweight, and then maintained it for those weights. So that's what you have to do. You have to make sure you're not losing too much size, too much power. It's not just about making the weight, because anybody here could just drop their weight, but that's about doing it right, you know?
Thanks.
Anyone can lose weight, you know?
The punches coming at you, how did you feel the difference?
Well, it was weird, like that as well. The first time I ever got dropped in my whole career was at 154. So I'm not sure if that was part of the play, but it probably coincided with me coming older as well. Against John Jackson, I was dropped heavy in the first round, and I'm not sure if that might like put a little bit of doubt in my mind. But that was the last time I ever fought the weight as well. So the punch coming out, like, in terms of John Jackson's hard to tell, because John Jackson's such a ferocious puncher, you know. He might have knocked out. He could knock out a lot of middleweights anyway, because he's such a big
good
puncher.
Pedigree.
Yeah, big puncher. I think he's in the Contender now, this new series of The Contender. I think it's on ITV4, so we might be able to get to see it. Yeah, see a bit of it.
Andre Ward's hosting that, isn't he?
Yeah.
We never mentioned Paddy Barnes.
Oh, yeah, Paddy Barnes.
Is that the end for him? Like, what a nightmare. His nose is broken in the first round, and, you know, he took a nasty body shot. But if he was to continue, the kind of looking at the fight, you were thinking, you know, the guy he's fighting is too big for him. So he's got to drop.
Yeah, he's got to be at his normal weight. I don't know. It's hard to know. It's hard to know. When you see him fight so valiantly and with such courage and heart and being so honest, that's so after the fight. That was so admirable. So it's hard to criticize and kick a man when he's down. I won't do that. But he's got to be honest with himself and say, look, I was too heavy. I shouldn't be fighting at bantamweight. I'm not sure whose decision that was, whether it was his or whoever it was, he shouldn't be fighting at that weight. Because from the first, you know, when you come out, from the first bell, you come out and you've just, like, his opponent just, like, just you just put something out there, and it's kind of a throwaway punch. It's like, so I don't intend this to land, but I'm just loosening my arms. And the guy actually caught him with the first, like, throwaway left hook that he got. And you could see, like, it didn't rock Paddy, but you could see it had a little effect on his legs, and he was like, it's going to be a long night. And even he's thinking, then the next punch, his nose is gone. And you think, like, this it's a disaster. But look, he fought, he showed his heart and courage. And if he should go down, he has to go down the weight. And all those things that he showed in that, the technique, the courage, and to come back and fight like that and fight through the pain, Imagine having your nose broken in two places, yeah. Apparently.
He said he couldn't even see properly.
And fighting on like that, I think it would be a sad note to end his career on. I think he should come back. I think he should. I think there's more in him. He has to be disciplined. He has to make weight. He has to take this thing seriously. Like, I know he was such a decorated amateur that he was in a rush to get to the top quickly as a pro. He didn't fit. And in some ways, didn't disrespect the game, but he didn't take his time. Look at Michael. He's learning. He's getting the apprenticeship. And Paddy took a different attitude, a different approach, where he wanted to be at the top straight away. And at those lower weights, you can do that. And he certainly has the talent and all the things I mentioned before to compete at that at the highest levels. But you have to serve your time. And I think get down to the proper weight. Have a couple of disciplined fights at those weights and then challenge again. Because I wouldn't like to see him, like, for all he's done for boxing, for Irish boxing, I wouldn't like to see him end his career on that note.
He's notoriously honest after fights. Even when he won his first bronze medal, he basically said, I'm a loser, like, I don't want to. But then, on reflection, he realised, you've won a medal. That's an incredible achievement. And then he goes on and wins another medal. So I wonder, now, in the last few days, he kind of thought about it, think, do you know what, I'm being way too hard on myself. I was in with a guy, Mojica, who, was too big and too strong for me. If I drop down a weight and I'm sensible about things, there's a few fights left for him.
Well, it's a hard lesson to learn, but what that will, if it's going to teach him anything, is that you can't cut corners in this game. You can't. You have to take it deadly serious, because it is your life. Your life is in hands. He's got two young girls at home, and I'm sure it was horrific for them watching him go in that fight, because at this stage in his life, that's what he's got to be thinking about, securing his family future and protecting himself and being at the right weight, because he's cheating himself by not fighting at the right weight. And not doing himself justice. That's what people, in a way, I was going to say that's what people will remember him in America as, but the fight he put up, people, they don't want to see him again because of that fight, battling against the odds against a bigger guy, but no one to blame but himself.
And himself and Colin have dovetailed basically since they turned pro, been on a lot of cards together, so it would make sense if he is going to come back to be on that Belfast card, and it's probably something he could get himself up for.
His nose healing time, it's a long time, a broken nose, and then he's got to be ready for training and sparring as well, so it might take a bit of time.
Ruthless Rowland over there, chuck him back in.
It's a funny one, three Olympic cycles, and it can't not but take its toll. I know making weight is never easy, but, going to the well again.
It just gets to the point where you're so burnt out from it, And just to have that discipline of, denying yourself just simple food, and water, and just denying yourself that, and especially for how long he's been doing it. If he wants to walk away now, he'll always be remembered for the good things he's done, and the character that he is, he's given a lot more to Irish boxing, and he's such a colourful character, So it's whatever he wants to do himself, but I would love to see him come back and not end his career on that note.
That was Sunday night, and the previous night over in Dallas was the big show globally of the weekend, a pound for pound clash, Mikey Garcia and Errol Spence, and weight was also a factor in that one. Although the point I would make about Errol Spence, who was a dominant winner in the end, he didn't make weight a huge issue in the beginning of the fight. It was almost he wanted to prove that he was more skillful than Garcia to begin with, and then towards the end of the fight he kind of started dominating him a bit more physically. What did you think of that one?
Too good and too big. It was, and I like what I really liked about Errol Spence was that he was going for the knockout. No, he wasn't happy. He was cruising. He was it was no way he was going to lose that fight after a certain point. But he was actually going for the knockout, and that's what I like to see. I like to see you finish.
And the size became such a big factor. It's like people needed something to talk about, because this is a pay-per-view event and they wanted to give Mikey some sort of a chance. They were like, he might be more skillful. But in all the talk of the leap up in weight, it almost got lost that Errol Spence is an unbelievable technician.
Class, yeah. I mean, the only person that you can say, the only debate really at welterweight is it's Crawford or Spence, really. Yeah, and you know, maybe some people watching the other night would have thought, Thurman. You know what, I actually put...
Put Thurman in that class?
I put Keith Thurman in there, yeah.
Well, I would have.
Well, if he's active, would have.
See, like, I know he's back. Maybe his next fight, we'll see exactly where Thurman is. Like, has that injury taken its toll? But we all want to see Spence and Crawford. But I think watching the fight, you know, it was quite clear early on, like, it was only going one way. And I know what you mean, that people, the closer we got to the fight, we talked about it last week, where
there were people tweeting saying, I've given Garcia a chance. Matthew Macklin said it, he thought Garcia was going
to
win.
Yeah, see, you listen to what Garcia is saying and then you think, oh, maybe, yeah. But the way I looked at it afterwards, I was thinking, it's almost like Micah Garcia and his friends were around one night just chilling out, and they started naming off boxers, who could you mix it with? And someone mentioned Errol Spence, and maybe his mate said, he wouldn't last with him. And he's like, oh no, I'll show you, I'll prove you wrong. And he did, but he didn't win a round. And, you know, at one stage I was looking at his corner and thinking, you got to pull him out here.
When that fight was announced, we were all kind of looking around going, why is this fight happening? It's not needed. It's actually just slowing up the rest of the welterweight division. Garcia jumped up 2 weights. He gave all the advantages. He ceded all the advantages to Spence. Didn't even make him come down to 145 or some sort of catchweight fight. I don't know what his management team are thinking. I don't know. His brother, Robert Garcia, is a great man for taking plaudits when they're going around. He needs to take an awful lot of criticism for that. That fight should have been stopped after the 9th round. There was no game plan. There was no change in game plan. He was basically a punch bag for 12 rounds. And it could do irreparable damage to him.
It doesn't look like now it was as bad as, say, when you think of Kell Brook and Golovkin.
Well, after that 9th round, I mean, he was only throwing single-digit punches for the last 5 or 6 rounds. I mean, the ref should have stopped it if the corner didn't, so...
He did threaten to stop it, Robert Garcia. He said, I'm going to pull you out now.
Well, if he's at that, he should have stopped it.
Yeah.
Mm. And, I mean, if the plan was to go to welterweight eventually, he should have had 1 or 2 fights, if not 3 fights at 140. He probably would have cleaned up there, and then he can go and negotiate with the big guys at 147 and maybe meet a catchweight at 144, 145. But it was pointless. I don't know what it does for his career, really. And again, it just slowed up the...
He wanted to be a badass.
He got a badass beat.
That's some motivation to have, isn't it? Why have you stepped up 2 weight divisions to fight the best fighter? Because I want to be a badass.
Like, not even, like, as you said, not even going
just,
up.
It just says, like, his mates have said, oh, you can't do that, you're not
you can't
a badass.
Do it. And he's
you're
like, I'll prove you wrong. Like, it's like, you know, the Back to the Future when they call Marty McFly a chicken. He's like, I'll show you. And... What does he do now, though? Because he's obviously gone, he's got up the weight, so...
145. That's what he weighed.
Yeah.
Like, and you could see that, like, the difference in the sizes, the muscle tone.
Yeah.
He was in the wrong division. 140. Go to 140 now and see what he can do there. He's still a quality operator, but who knows what damage that fight's done to him. His reputation is hurt after it, because he took a sort of shellacking.
Mm. And Errol Spence, from his point of view... Manny Pacquiao was sort of the mooted fight after, and that would be a perfect one from a mainstream point of view. I know this was in the Dallas Cowboys Stadium, which is a great platform to begin with, and on Fox, and it got the full Fox backing on First Take and all these different platforms. So if he knocks off Manny Pacquiao, who's seen better days, you know, it seems like a good catapult.
Why are you smiling? You don't like that?
We're just going to serve Manny Pacquiao to Errol Spence and bring in the new generation, Simon.
Well, like, they did 47,000 in the Dallas ring. That's, for America, that's a huge crowd. That is a huge crowd. And I think it's coming up to, like, 350,000 buys on pay-per-view for two guys making their debut and not necessarily household names. They've done well, you know, and they've sold it well.
I think that crowd beat... Manny Pacquiao fought there twice against Claudio and Margarito, and I don't think he did 47,000. I think he was just shy of 45, so... Yeah, I mean, Spence, Pacquiao was huge. I think Pacquiao was waiting to get the Floyd Mayweather call-out because Floyd was there in the ring as well. And then it was just the whole thing looked very awkward and contrived.
I don't want to see that again.
I know we don't, but it was just when they were like, Manny, come over here, do you want the fight? I was like, yeah, of course I'll fight him.
Before the fight on Saturday, what was your feeling about Spence and Crawford, if you were going to rank them? I mean, what are you feeling after watching the fight?
It's a toss-up, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a toss-up.
Unfortunately, we don't know if we're ever going to see it.
No. Unless one of them, just goes to a different promoter. That's it. You know, if just one of them gets pissed off where they are in terms of how they're being promoted or whatever's happened. If see if they can capitalise on this and make Spence a household name. Like, it has to get to a point where the fight's big enough for them to work together.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what it's going to be.
That can take some time.
Even now, if they were to fight now, would it be a huge seller? Maybe now.
Like, boxing fans would want to see it, but I know what you mean, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Would it commercially justify the fight being made?
No, it hasn't burst into the mainstream, neither Crawford or Spence.
So it needs that. Well, Khan now, like, him beating Mike Garcia, and if he fights Pacquiao, he's a big name, huge name then, in boxing, and for anybody who watches boxing. And then if Crawford beats Khan, that's going some way in that right direction.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about those potential fights closer to the time. On today's show, we're also going to get to this weekend's fights, which are in London. But before that, we're going to look ahead to next weekend, which sees a huge card in the National Stadium. Eric Donovan headlining on that one. And Simon caught up with his coach, Kenny Egan.
Camp is going according to plan. Everything is nearly coming to its milk, as they say. Really in good shape, very focused. Training now is very specific in relation to what he needs to do on the 30th of March. We're not wasting any sessions. He's very calculated now, and he's in the zone. Just taking the weight down now as he does, and we'll be ready to go on the 30th. He's in really, really good space.
Two boys have previously sparred, and it wasn't mentioned at the press conference. How much has that played on Eric's mind, or was it an insight into what Stephen's going to bring?
Eric hasn't mentioned that. In the 12-week camp that we've had, the 10 weeks of the 12, he hasn't mentioned it, and I don't think it's a cause for anything. You know, it's an old spar. It doesn't mean anything. What's important is what happens on the night. Both lads are going to get prepared to their max for this fight. This is a really important fight for both lads. We're going to be no stone unturned, and it's all on the night. Whoever has prepared right and whoever's mind is clear and ready on the night is going to win the fight. And for me, I think Eric Donovan is light years ahead of Stephen. That's no disrespect to Stephen either, but Eric Donovan, with the amateur pedigree he has and his transformation into the pro game, he's just a better fighter. But he needs to prove that on himself on the night. There's no point me saying it here in front of you on the camera. Eric has to prove how good he is on the night, and I expect a really solid, strong performance from Eric.
And just finally, do you think all the pressure's on Eric coming into this fight, since he's headlining the bill and he's kind of the came through the high performance unit, and as you said,
a lot of people would suggest that Eric is under pressure to try and win this fight, but Eric has taken this with a pinch of salt. It's just another fight to Eric. We're keeping it simple. All Eric has to do is perform on the night. Forget about results, forget about who he's fighting. Just perform. He needs a good performance. We expect nothing less from Eric. If he doesn't perform on the night, he's going to lose the fight. But he knows he's well within his reach to win this fight if he performs on the night.
All right, so Ken Egan there, catching up with our own Simon Maguire. Good vibe at the old open workouts there, Simon, was there?
Yeah, the press conference was a good 2 months ago now at this stage, so it's good to see it winding down, and they all look on weight and ready to go. I did notice Eric did 3 rounds open workout, and I did notice Stephen having a good look at him, seeing what was going on. He said afterwards he wasn't, but he was. And while Eric was touching up the pad, Stephen got in and started battering the hands off your man in there. So I think it's going to be a great fight. And I was talking to the promoters. They're almost sold out. So it should be a raucous atmosphere on the night.
Andy, you were down at the workouts as well, was you?
Yeah, I popped down. I missed Eric's. I saw a bit of Stephen's. And Stephen looked sharp.
Yeah.
Yeah, he looked sharp. I'm sure Eric looked sharp as well, but he did look sharp. It's coming along nicely now. It's interesting.
More pressure than Eric, isn't it?
Yeah, and I know Kenny was deflecting it in the interview, but I feel like there probably is, because he has the name and reputation and kind of to uphold. And it's an upset if Eric loses, I think. You know, it is an upset, but it's going to be a tough fight. It's going to be a tough fight for both men. Eric has to box and be elusive and try to fall back on his amateur days and use some of that skill, and then see if he can insert himself later on in the fight. Try not to stand and trade with McPhee. But McPhee's he's not a big puncher, he's not a big guy, but he's an aggressive guy who will keep coming, and he's kind of relentless. And it makes the clashes of styles make for a good. And hopefully we'll get them in here next week and have a preview with them themselves and hear what they have to say.
The fact that it's on TV as well. Like, can you remember when you knew your fights were on TV?
Yeah, especially in Ireland.
Pressure
for these guys. Yeah, like, probably slightly different for me, because I would have, you know, from an amateur you would have had some exposure, and then you kind of. But for these guys, this is probably the first time they've been on national TV, and boxing. And that's a whole different pressure for them, because your neighbour can watch. You know, the people on the street and in your hometown would never see you fight, and they'd probably ask, oh, how'd you get on? Yeah, I won, or this or that. But now they'll actually have a chance to see. So, you know, you're going to be living with this for the next while. Both of these guys are going to be living with this. So it just adds a little bit of extra spice to it that they'll want to perform, you know.
Yeah, and Ray Moylett said that as well after the TV fight in Castlebar, that more and more people are coming up to him and recognising him and talking to him about the fight. Yeah. That alone indicates that...
So you don't want to let yourself down?
No, not at all, no.
Yeah, and we'll have plenty of coverage of that card beforehand and on the night, hopefully, as well. Speaking of Irish interest, Jason Quigley returns to this side of the Atlantic for the first time as a pro, and he's fighting this decent London card at the Copper Box. A few different wrinkles for Jason. Like, he's moving up the ranks within the Ingle gym, because Billy Joe Saunders has since left, so he's kind of one of the prized assets now. Are you expecting him to put on a show this weekend?
Yeah, he's fighting a guy from Finland. I can't remember the guy's last name. I think he's 10-1. Not much of a puncher. So it's important for him to look good, yeah, and get the ball rolling again and get some excitement again. And
it's great to see him get a fight.
Now he's on early in the card. I think his fight's going to be shown on Facebook Live.
Oh, right, okay.
So it's not going to actually be on Sky TV. So people have to tune in to Facebook, to Sky or Matchroom's Facebook to watch it. But that's easy to get. And look forward to watching him fight and getting busy.
Even to get his face around the place, like, he's been a Sky ambassador for a long time, and he's such a charming fella that he'll easily capture the imagination when he gets there. So it's just important to get himself.
Yeah, I've always been impressed by him. I remember my wife is from Achill, and they have like a sports ball every year, and Jason Quigley was one of the speakers. He had just gone pro, and I think he was only 23 at the time, but the whole room was just in awe of the way he spoke. Everyone was just so impressed by this guy. Like, you know, he's so clean living, and he was asked about, like, you know, being a 23-year-old that doesn't drink. He said he'd never touched a drop of alcohol, but I was just amazed that night. Like, a guy from Donegal that come to Achill, and like, the whole room was just captivated by him.
And is that a big rivalry, Achill and Donegal?
No. Although, no. Stephen Rochford comes to Donegal, maybe. Yeah.
I remember Jason as an amateur, and he was a European champion and stuff. He was like highly decorated, silver medalist. I never knew him. I think I might have sparred with him one day up in the stadium and just moved around. But one thing that I got from him and from people who've been around him, like Zoe and Billy Walsh, that he was a winner, that his attitude really set him apart. And maybe that feeds into what you were just saying about him. And I wonder how that's kind of developed now that he's had this few years as a pro, and that it's kind of been stop and start. You know, it's very easy to get disillusioned. Mm. Now, he's training and living in Sheffield, probably not the most glamorous or nicest place to live, but it might will kind of strengthen his resolve if he can prove that he wants, like, if he wants it while he's doing all this, while he's having these long delays and having a tough life in the gym, because this is a tough gym, the Ingle gym, that it will show that he really wants it, you know. So yeah, hopefully I'd love to see him go out there and put on a great show. And he has the attitude. Sometimes it doesn't always work like you want it, and I'm sure he has the intention of doing it. Sometimes it doesn't always work, but I would just like to see the stars line him to look sensational and then really get people buzzing about him on this side of the Atlantic. Yeah,
the move to the Ingle gym, he's talked about it a lot, that living in LA in the Manny Robles gym, he felt like he'd already made it. He was living in Marina Del Rey and he felt like a champion already, but he wanted to get back to sort of real gym life, and it's kind of got him back on the right track. It's actually a good card. Charlie Edwards is headlining, defending his world title. He kind of went viral a bit on social media, the pictures of him and his mom after he won the world title. And similarly to Jono, he took a world title shot quite early in his career and fell quite short. I think it was on the Golovkin-Burke undercard. And then when he did get his second chance, he really took it with both hands, and he's headlining. It's good to see that as well.
Yeah, he's a great guy, Charlie Edwards. He boxed in the Fratum for a while, and he's a lovely guy. Lovely guy, and it's one of the best stories to see him win. His mother's been very sick for a long time, and she was there. And great that he got the title. Now, there is a rematch clause for him and Rosales, the champion who'd beat Paddy Barnes in the previous fight. But I think that'll be later on in the summer. He's fighting this guy called Moreno from Spain. It's got an opponent for him. Yeah. Charlie will look good. And
it's a nice little mix there because you've got Kalia Fai as well, obviously, and then Rung Safai, who you had in your pen for pen list as well. Yeah. And then Andrew Selby's actually fighting a final eliminator for that.
It's like it's, yeah, so he's pushing for the belt. So that's a good one for the British boxing fans, I guess, you know, to watch those two hopefully fight maybe towards the end of the year.
And we spoke a couple of weeks ago just about Matchroom Stable as opposed to Frank Warren Stable, and that this transitional period where they're looking for stars, and Eddie Hearn and Adam Smith both name check Joshua Boazzi as the guy that's going to be that guy. Mm. He's fighting this weekend. Liam Conroy should win.
Yeah, he should win. Conroy's a tough guy. Will fight. So it should be good. You know, they're giving him a good build up, Boazzi. You can see, I've seen a few things on Sky, on the Soccer AM and stuff like that, where they have all the big fighters, the household names quoted and mentioning him in glowing terms. Yeah. And he has it, yeah.
He's an impressive guy, isn't he?
He's impressive, yeah. And he's recently featured in GQ, I think, with Stormzy on the cover. So he's kind of got that little bit of crossover, but he's a very clean living person.
Yeah.
And has a little bit of it. I remember even watching him in the Olympics in Rio, and I thought, this guy's good. This guy could make it, you know?
Yeah.
And he's from Croydon, which is where Adam Roof. So I spoke to Adam Roof about him, he'd be one to get, but Adam only had eyes for Josh Kelly, so that's the way it went. But he's the one that hopefully built. Lawrence Okolie, too, is on the card. They'll try and build him as well. He's one, he's a cruiserweight, he's entertaining, he's a big puncher, so.
Dillian White a couple of weeks ago,
That was weird, wasn't it? Funny. Did you see a little clip of the sparring that they had?
No.
Yeah, there was a little clip of them sparring, and I don't know, it might have been edited, but it looked like Okolie was doing all right. You know, I'm sure, I wouldn't like to see that fight.
He's a nightmare.
Dillian would definitely go for him.
He's a nightmare, cruiserweight particularly. You saw it against Askin, where it was kind of just, Askin couldn't get anything done.
So long, so big and powerful too, you know.
Yeah.
Knocked out Luke the Duke Watkins, and he recently has been sparring with Tyson Fury for the camp with Wilder, so he's got some pedigree a little bit. You know, what he does is awkward and it's kind of uneducated, but in some ways it's very effective for him because you can't judge him, you can't time him, and he will get you at some stage. He will land that right hand, and he has big power.
Just one more quick word on Boazzi, who has this sort of rivalry with Anthony Yard, even though they might never fight. It's just the way that stars have aligned with those two, but Yard is actually mandatory for Kovalev, and that might have looked like an easy touch a year ago, but it seems Kovalev's not quite done. So
he was on a few weeks ago, actually. Yard, he was on it was a Friday night. I was watching him.
I can't remember actually.
He fought in the Albert Hall, wasn't
it? BTA. I was watching it. Yeah.
Who do you see at those guys? Who do you rate the higher, Boazzi or Yard?
I like Boazzi. Yard, the hype hasn't really matched up to what I've seen so far. He's an impressive guy as well. It's a fight, it's kind of one of those, much like Groves and De Gale, if they fight earlier on in their career, it's not going to deter them from pursuing their own avenues later down. So you wouldn't mind seeing them fight now and then maybe again down the line. Anthony Sims Jr. is also in that mix as well, although he's moved down to 168. Did you have any experience with him? Did you come across him?
No, I never. I only seen him the first time. He fought a couple of weeks ago, Anthony Sims Jr. It was the first I ever heard of him, yeah.
Right, okay. And then last but not least, Lewis Ritson. Back on the
new improved.
Yeah, he's moved up. I'm not sure. He's moved up to 140, which you always worry when people struggle at the weight, that they just jump up a little bit willy-nilly. I think he was such a dominant force at lightweight that, domestically speaking, obviously, and the advantages he had down there might necessarily translate to 140, so he might be a bit quick to be doing this.
You're worried about him, Ron?
A little bit, yeah. No, he should get through this tonight. It's a WBA... ranking title.
It's tough when you invest so much into a boxer, isn't it? Emotionally, and you kind of vouch for him, and then he goes and loses. Then what do you do?
Because he's not normally the kind of boxer I would like, because he's kind of marauds forward and punches sort of a little bit recklessly. But no, there's just something about the way he rose up the ranks. He's just knocking all these people out. So hopefully he can. It's a really good card, actually.
Sure, I think he's fighting 19-2-2. Not much of a puncher, so it'd be a rehabilitation job for him, you know, confidence and getting back out there.
Yeah, I'd prefer to be stayed at the weight he was at. I think maybe jumping up was a bit too. I think there's unfinished business at 135 for him.
Sometimes it's knee jerk, isn't it? The answer, what do you do? And it's kind of an out, a little out. You're not really facing up to your failings. You're kind of saying, look, I failed, but look, I had a weight problem, yeah. So I'm going to move up, and that's going to cure everything.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to stay at your weight and say, look, I'll go back and I'll beat that guy, because he might beat that guy. It was such a close fight that the guy just kind of broke his heart going down the stretch and went on to win well. But Ritson, that fight could have gone either way had he just had a bit more, I don't know, a bit more resolve about him. You know, if he just would have stuck, even though he was taking shots and it wasn't working, just stuck at it.
Yeah, that'd be my feeling. I think he probably should have stuck around at 135, but sources behind the scenes are kind of saying it's been coming for a while, he's been struggling for a long time, so he's just a bit young to be making that move, I think. We'll see how it turns out for him. There's loads of news to get to, but we are actually a little bit tight on time. The Deontay Wilder, not much has changed in that picture. He's turned down $100 million from DAZN to stay with Showtime, so there's no sign of...
$100 million?
Three-fight deal for to fight Brazil and then Joshua twice.
So, 20 for Brazil and then 40 each time for Joshua.
He turned it down?
He turned that down. So we'll see. He's fighting Brazil on Showtime.
What's he getting? He must be getting something similar from Showtime.
I don't know where they're getting the money. It's not on pay-per-view, so...
Also, so, like, what would Joshua be getting? See, Joshua's getting more, so that's probably...
That's it, yeah.
That's probably
the thing. He's
thinking, I deserve it.
At a certain point, you have to focus on what you're getting.
Yeah, exactly. 100% of 40 million is better than 50% of, you know...
It's a fight like we all want to see, because... But if Wilder was to go and beat Joshua, then, you know, that puts him in the position to say, right, now I get paid more for the rematch.
Yeah, you have to beat the man. But apparently it was already, like... And the thing was, it was weird, because had he lost to Brazil, he still would have got the Joshua fight. But like, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Yeah. It's a good fight, though, him and Brazil.
Yeah, we'll talk about that fight, obviously, closer to the time. It's a bit of a heavyweight mix around that time with Joshua and Fury, mooted for the middle of June as well. Just a few last quick points. Best of luck to Lynn Harvey, who's fighting for the European title. And congratulations to Wayne McCullough, who's in the International Boxing Hall of Fame, headlined by Bernard Hopkins and Juan Manuel Marquez. It just shows those lads have been out of the game long enough that they're getting commemorated. Boxing's moving fast.
Great to have him in the International Hall of Fame. I'm not sure how many Irishmen are in there. But
some chin on
in the elite group anyway. Also, Amy Broadhurst.
Yeah.
Won a gold medal at the European Championships.
Serial winner. She just can't stop winning.
Great.
And she obviously had to fund that trip herself to Russia because, you know, funding's a bit tricky at these times, but because it's a non-ranking weight. Mm. But she got the job done, and, you know, it's just she'll go from strength to strength, hopefully, an Olympic hope.
That's a disgrace.
Did you see who was waiting for her at the airport when she got back then?
The main man.
Bernard Dunn.
Champ.
Yeah.
That's a disgrace, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just like she's the only one to win the gold medal, and she has to fund it herself.
A GoFundMe page, but it's grim. It's grim scenes, but at least she.
Look at yourself, like, come on, yeah. Whoever it is, the IBA, the Sports Council, get it together.
Yeah, I mean,
there was a lot. Like they sent half a team. Mm. You know, they didn't send a full strength team. We could be talking about more gold medals on an international, a European championship. You imagine if like an athletics win European gold, the buzz is all over the place. You know, it's just a. We've been embarrassed by, not embarrassed, but we've come kind
of... Embarrassment of riches.
Yeah, because it's so common in boxing now that they're succeeding so much that, like, it doesn't even make the papers. Like a European gold medal, any other sport, it's all over the news, it's on the 6-1, it's everywhere.
It's true.
Come on, let's, like, give her due and fund these athletes.
Is the problem that a lot of these boxers have overachieved and then people are saying, well... Like they're still getting.
It's taken for granted.
Yeah, they're still getting these results, so they'll always get these results. So people.
They won't always get these results because if they keep cutting it and Zor leaves and Bernard Dunn doesn't fancy it and then it goes back to the old dark days and we're just a, you know, we're a very small country and we're punching well above our weight in terms of winning international medals. Like, and come the Olympics and we're not winning and they're not even anyone there, they'll be saying, well, where's all the boxers? What's happened now? And like. You'll see, this is it, because fighters will keep turning pro.
Yeah.
How can you sustain yourself? How can you live a life in this day and age if you're funding your own trips to Russia to box for Ireland?
Yeah, that's a disgrace. I mean, like the Brits have obviously put an awful lot of money into cycling. You don't see them cutting in the cycling funding, and they're getting medals galore at World Games, Olympic
it's
Games.
It's shown over the years, you fund, you get success. That's they go hand in hand, you know, it's... There's many reasons why they go hand in hand, but they do.
Yeah, we spoke to her before the fight, and she, or before the national finals rather, and she was making the point that at a certain point she does qualify for England because her father's from there and she's boxed in the ABAs, won the ABAs, so it just shows what kind of level she's at. And like all she wants to do is box for Ireland. Ireland's her sole focus, but if it gets to 5 years down the line, she still can't get an Olympic qualifier, she's going to have to seriously think about fulfilling her dream one way or another. So,
I know I don't, like, it's off the point, but like, we're talking about her, would she fight Kelly Harrington, but also just to say well done to Kelly Harrington as well for auctioning her championship belt and Irish Press. I think it went to like 3,500. I'm not sure on that, but she went for a lot of money and helped a very good cause. So, but back to the boxing.
Yeah.
Who wins if they fight? Is Aimee Broadhurst getting closer? Or is,
just judging off last year, it's hard to look past that, isn't it? It's still a bit soon, but the sound bites coming out of Aimee would suggest she's getting more and more confident of that clash. So I can't see it happening anytime soon, to be honest. I think they kind of have their own agendas at the moment, but if Kelly's still around for Paris in 2024,
it'd be
great
not to have it in a championship. It'd be great for someone to promote it for whatever reason, charity, and get the two of them to box for a good cause and put it in like a hotel or in the conference centre and let them before one of them turns pro or goes to the Olympics, let them see who's the better one.
Yeah, well, it's a good time for Irish boxing all around the last couple of weeks. Thanks, lads, for coming in, and we'll chat to you next week. Thanks for tuning in.
And let's hope tonight, this is what... Oh, there's a brilliant red hook from Sean Byron. Unbelievable! What a left hook!
And he's got the hook. And he's in trouble. He is in trouble.
A hook to die for there for Bernard Gunn. Carnival fights back. Has to fight back.
He's still wobbly with those big left hooks and those big right hands. That's the key to this door.
Now it's Cordoba's chance.
Unbelievable stuff.
But the world champion can hit and he can sting and he can hurt. And Dunn is in trouble here. He's got to fight this one more down and you know the referee can step in here. Protect the bell goes, and the referee almost stepped in to a done right hook. Oh, that was a rattler.
This fight is going one way, then another way, then back again. This is one of the best fights I've seen in a long, long, long time. He has it going!
He has it going! One more touch to go! Fought so hard for here tonight. This is a brilliant fight, one of the best we've ever had. And Cordoba is gone. Bernard Gunn is the champion of the world. Fantastic, Bernard. Fantastic.